Hello, and welcome back to The Great Game. I'm Patrick, flying solo in this episode, and I was back talking to Very Large Huge Games, specifically about Aftermath. This is a game that came about a few years back, evolved into a Very Large Huge Game earlier this year, and was tagged as Tea and Biscuits at the end of the world, which, from all reports, it seems to have lived up to that tagline. I talked to Zane and Chris from Very Large Huge Games about Aftermath, the design challenges and evolution of the game, and how Zane upscaled it to bring it from a more traditional size game to this 150-plus player game. I do apologize ahead of this episode. Not only was my microphone on its last legs, but I was also in the middle of having the flu, and I was convinced I was on the back end of the flu. So I think a little bit of fogginess led to even less coherence and more meandering than usual from me. Thankfully, the lads compensated with stories of cannibal circuses and kept us on track. So I hope you enjoy, and without further ado, here's Aftermath with Chris and Zane. So, Zane, Chris, thank you for joining us again. You were actually on the podcast only a couple episodes ago, although it was some time ago in reality. We've had a little bit of a hiatus. But for those who missed you the first time around, did you just want to introduce yourselves and sort of where you fit in the mega game world? Maybe starting with you, Zane.
Hi, yeah. So, Zane, my mega gaming sort of stuff started with me setting up Diversionary Games to run mega games in Southampton in the UK, where we designed and ran a few games. And then Chris and the Very Large Huge Games accidentally told me they needed some help. So I got involved there and haven't left since.
Yeah, it wasn't accidental.
Strategic.
Yeah, oh, yeah. My name's Chris, so I help run Very Large Huge Games in the UK and also Mega Game Assembly, where we've got the calendar of all the games we know about in the world. It was very, very strategic to ask Zane. Definitely knew that, knew that he was very good at design games and we needed some help. So, yeah, brought him on board and never left since, thankfully.
And so today we're going to be talking about Aftermath and how that has evolved from a mega game to a Very Large Huge Game. This was one that you ran earlier this year. Was it your third of these very large, huge games?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, so before that, we ran First Contact 2035, which is our sort of take on Alien Arrival for 200 people. And so we ran that twice. And then we felt like we needed to become games in Very Large, Huge Games. And I pestered Zane for many years, about running Aftermath again. And fortunately, he agreed. So that's what we went with next.
And so, Zane, you were the sort of lead designer, I suppose, of Aftermath originally. Take us back to that time and just, I guess, give everyone a bit of a pitch that you were giving to people then about what this game was going to be about.
So, yeah, many, many, many years ago, I feel like I need the Twilight music to, you know, send us back in time a little bit. many years ago. I think with that, I would just change jobs from flood risk management into oil spill. So I was doing a lot of emergency response stuff. I was looking at different countries' ways of reacting to responses. And I got very intrigued with the idea of running a sort of fun mega game, but using some of the sort of recovery and response techniques that the countries had, but on a sort of smaller, more localized scale. And I'd also been watching a wonderful program in the UK called Survivors, where there was a near extinction event and the majority of the population had been wiped out. And these very normal people were trying to rebuild and create new governments and survive and do all the horrific things that humans do. So I kind of thought, wouldn't it be fun to sort of do something like that? It was actually originally on the more serious side of mega games. That was foolish of me. Players don't want serious, they want fun. So I took the sort of this 1970s Survivors TV show and thought I'd mix it up with probably Australia's best export, Mad Max. And there was born Aftermath in its first version. So in this game, people were playing small groups of survivors that had survived a near extinction event. The near extinction event sort of didn't matter. It was more about what came afterwards. How could you rebuild? What would society look like? How would you sort of rebuild those relationships and negotiations with other groups, as well as sort of the last remnants of local government trying to do their best? Whereas, you know, before the event, they'd been worried about potholes and school closures, and now suddenly they're trying to build after the world has been torn apart and trying to pretend that they could still do it. So it was these two opposing sides trying to rebuild society, trying to sort of survive and have a lot of fun. That wasn't an elevator pitch, but that was brief bit of sort of where it came from. So
no, thank you. And it makes a lot of sense. I've actually seen a few pieces of that Survivors show that you're referencing, and when you first brought it up, it was either in our last conversation or maybe in the conversation you had with the Mega Game Assembly. I remember getting really excited because it's not that I'd ever thought about having a mega game based on that show or that setting or that scenario, but I just had never known anyone who had seen that show, which is probably uncommon for you, but probably a bit confusing for you. You've probably know a lot of people who've seen it, but over here it was like finding an old relic. But I have to ask, you mentioned that it sort of started off serious and then maybe became a little bit less so. I found that that's a recurring theme with a lot of designs. How fast do you feel that transition happened during the design process?
Probably not as fast as it should have done. I think my new mantra, especially with very large, huge games, is fun, fun, fun. Like, yeah. Is this part of the game fun? Like, that is what we're aiming for. Back then, I was doing scenario testing in Flood Risk and Oil Response. So there was just a lot more of a serious response to what I was doing. And I found it very interesting, the sort of more scenario-based mega game. You know, there's this quite serious issue, how do we deal with it sort of thing, was quite interesting. I then started to realise that actually players don't want to be that serious, understandably, in their leisure time. So I think it probably took too long. Really, I think even on the day, I was hoping there would be a sort of a line of sort of seriousness. I think my main mistake of the first run is I thought it'd be great to give players the ability to create their own survivor groups and give them free reign. So actually all the original first survivor groups, and there were some brilliant ones that came out of it, but player groups actually just invented their own survivor group. How they'd survived, what they'd done in the past, and we got quite a range of strange and interesting things come out of it, which was quite juxtaposed, wrong word, can't say it this early in the morning. It was quite opposite to the, you know, quite serious nature of the government organisations. You know, they've got the police, the army, and the civil authorities working together, and then we have quite crazy, slightly Mad Max, I say slightly, very Mad Max survivor groups. And it was a little jarring in that first run, I think, at times.
Didn't you have a group of Apple Store employees?
Yeah, there was one group that were worshipping Apple. So they'd got stuff at Apple Store, and they were all Apple geniuses. That was one group. There was the Stag Do that never ended. Mm-hmm. So one group were on a stag do when the event happened and never stopped. They were lots of fun. Both groups were lots of fun and actually did some great stuff in the game. They're all very good role players and LARPers from the area. Mm-hmm. So there was, in fact, you can read the write-up. I think there's a link on the Diversionary Games site to a group of board game reviewers at the time called Misery Farmers, who were good friends, and they came along as bloodthirsty feminists who killed all men that came anywhere near their group. They did apologise a few times during the day for going quite so over the top. They had a lot of fun.
Well, at least they were polite about it.
They were polite about it. Whilst laughing, Yes, amongst many others.
Yeah.
But yes, it taught me that you need to vet player ideas a bit better.
Yeah, well, that's there's something that's been in the discourse in the Sydney group recently about, I guess, how you make sure that people are well prepared for what the game is about. I noted that on the Very Large Huge Games website for the big run of this, you did have a disclaimer on there giving sort of a content warning about some of the things that might be addressed in the game. And you even put an age bracket on this one, which I found interesting. I don't know if that's, it's probably not a first in your neck of the woods, but it is over here. How did you as a collective decide that this particular game needed to be disclosed that way?
I think that might have come from myself and sort of some of the work I do in the real world. So we do some stuff with schools and communities and stuff, and it was that realization that actually some of the stuff we're exploring in this game is could be quite full on. It doesn't have to be, but actually, you know, and I've had to be honest, I've had complaints in other games, my other game that we haven't turned large, very large, Infinite Horizons, where there are some things that mutate some people, and issues with changing pregnancies in a space colony, and actually had someone come up and basically say they'd wish that I'd mentioned this somewhere before the game. So that really sat with me a long time and made me think, actually, you know, we cover some bad things. We were going to run this at a convention. Most of the conventions in the UK have these sort of warnings if they're doing role-playing games with any of these themes. So I felt it would be a good idea to make sure we were very clear and open about it. And I think clear that we weren't going to go in certain directions as well. Like, we were going to accept, you know, cannibalism was going to happen. It's that kind of game. But we didn't want any form of discrimination or racism or anything like that to be allowed to sort of boil out of that. Because that kind of setting, you know, you think of Fallout and you've got all the sort of slavery stuff. That kind of genre can slip into that slightly authoritarian, quite vicious area quite quickly.
Yeah, for sure.
Talking to cannibalism, we absolutely, I think it was a great idea that Zane had, and I'm not sure many, if any, other games have done what we did for Aftermath, which is the content warning, but it's, like you said, it's very usual for other types of games here in the UK, I'm sure in other countries too, but with the cannibalism, we specifically called it out on the game, but we didn't have anybody in the, any survivor teams or anybody actually briefed to be cannibals in any way. But we had, I think, what, Zane, like 3 or 4 teams be full-out cannibals in the game? And I'm wondering if it's because we mentioned it on the content warning, and maybe we should just remove it from there. But it's, yeah, it was quite a fun game, but it was a lot of cannibalism I wasn't expecting.
I think it's the genre. It pulls that out of people. They think there's a food shortage, and they instantly invite people to the circus to be cooked into hot dogs.
Well, that's definitely, I mean, it's something that's fallen into a lot of our games here. Canonically, it was interesting what you were saying, though, about vetting player ideas, because a lot of the discourse I was mentioning about using these kind of content warnings is that, well, one, like Chris said, maybe it can encourage people, because if you're saying this could include this thing, then some certain crowds will be like, well, we're definitely going to go and have cannibalism in our narrative. But then also, I suppose you can't always capture everything that player creativity might bring into it. So I'd be interested to hear how you have managed to siphon that off, or any lessons that you've learned about doing that, Zane, from those early runs.
I think the first thing I learned from the early run was not to do it, even though there's a part of me that wants player to get involved and add that creativity. I think there's always a sort of a stretch goal with Aftermath, where I create a little bit of a sort of choose your own adventure bit at the beginning, as a sort of, as part of the sort of, not quite ticketing, but as part of the pre-game stuff, where instead of a casting set questionnaire, I run through a choose your own adventure, and it takes people through the setting, and they get a feeling then of how the world has collapsed and some of the choices they may have gone through. that's kind of how I want to do it now. So it's a bit more controlled, whereas that original run, I just went, you've survived. What group of people are you and where have you survived and how? And they just threw their idea back at me very, and I don't think I had the time to properly vet them, because really I'd probably needed to spend a couple of hours with each of those groups going through their idea, like a GM with a good roleplay group, you know, going through with your players what their idea is, how it fits into the setting, if it's right, what tweaks need making. Whereas if I had time in any of our runs, I would write a sort of choose your own adventure little intro to it, which I think is a way of getting the players to feel like they're involved. It's making some choices ahead of the game, but they're sort of limited within what you want them to be.
Yeah, that's something I've toyed with a little bit and would love to see how you would be able to implement that kind of pre-game in a mega game setting like Aftermath. Seems pretty built for it. So how did when was the first run of this, or when were you first designing the original mega game?
Now I can't remember dates. Chris might have to help me because he came to my first run.
I did. The first run I think was 2016, like November or something, or September. But I don't know when you were designing it, because I didn't know you before then.
If it was 2016, then I would have been designing it probably 2 or 3 months before, because that's the craziness.
2 or 3 months? Are you mad? Oh my God.
I probably booked the date before I'd even...
that's horrifying to me.
That's classic. That's classic mega game design 101.
Oh, it has been great.
I think it was probably boiling, like many games, they boil around in my head for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Before anything really sort of bubbles out. And I think Aftermath had probably been bubbling in my mind for quite a while, especially as I was doing the sort of incident response work. So that's, I was sort of in that field. I was doing these sort of incident response systems. I was writing a test scenario for a global event of a oil spill, not quite the same as a near extinction event, but possibly near extinction for some of the poor species that might have got involved. And I think that sent me down. So I think whilst I was doing that, on the side was bubbling along these ideas. And I think it really started with the government side of it. That was actually where the interest originally started. You know, if there's complete collapse, how do these small local authorities that sort of in, because it's very much based on the UK's response. And I don't know how much your listeners know about the way the UK government system is set up. And I don't know how similar it is to Australia, but we have local authorities, local councils. They're democratically elected. They have some councillors, but most of the work is done by council officers of various levels. And we just have these democratic people who sort of give a direction, but really all the work is done by these local officers. And in a response, it would be down to them, these local officers, to actually make the key decisions and respond. These elected councillors don't really have any heavy impact. So it was the idea that actually, you know, these fairly normal people were suddenly thrown into this quite intense, highly political landscape, and especially if they'd been near extinction and, you know, 99% of the population had been wiped out, actually the people that were left to respond and hold that line would have been quite junior. So it was this sort of idea that actually this group of people who have survived are trying to rebuild it, trying to do their best, but with this local authority twist on it, rather than big government, because actually our response stuff isn't done by, wouldn't be done directly by central government. It would all be done sort of locally. In fact, there's even a law which is in the game, which allows local government in an emergency to make a quick law change or legislation change to allow them to deal with recovery. And that sort of fed into this idea that they sort of suddenly disperse, and then they all have to answer to a higher committee called Gold and Silver Command, which are not their official names, but they're the names that they sort of get referred to by people. They have some proper silly other name these days, but Gold Command sitting above them that gives a sort of strategic direction. Silver Command sort of takes that, turns it into tactical directions and gives it to Bronze Control, but Bronze Control wasn't played in this. That sort of like localized firefighting groups or stuff like that. They're going to deal with an individual bit. So it started really all around that government bit. And then the idea of the survivor groups being out there and having their own ideas about how the world should be rebuilt and what sort of political system should be put back in place sort of came not as an afterthought, but as a sort of something to bounce back against for the. And I think the game would actually work as just survivors and just the government as separate games would work just as well. I don't know what Chris thinks about that, but in my mind, I think either of those two sides would work fine on their own as well as the two together.
Yeah, I think so. I know you've mentioned before about the sort of the scale difference between the government and the survivor teams. The survivor teams are what, 60 sort of people, and the government obviously have many, even in a completely cut down world of you know, most people have died, you've still got quite a lot of resources compared to the individual survivor group. So I know you think there's a huge scale difference between the two teams. But yeah, they definitely would. I think I'd love to play a gold silver command game, but I'm not sure how popular that would be with general hobbyist gamers.
Yeah. I don't throw enough Mad Max people in as the NPCs, I'm sure it'd be all right.
Wow, yeah, that's true.
And so I was just gonna say, so if you were saying that you could run this or to have two separate games with those that government and the survivor group separate, how in the current way that the game is designed, if we're still looking at the core aftermath, how do those two sides interact? What are the mechanisms in the game that they overlap in?
So everything's overlapping to a certain extent. The game focuses on, again, it's very UK focused, but we have Ordnance Survey mapping group in the UK that has mapped the whole of the country, and they produce these land ranger maps, which I now can't remember the scale of, which is terrible. But anyway, it's a fairly close scale. People use them for going for planning walks, and each area is one of these OS land ranger maps. So very sort of Boy Scout. You get a map, you look at that, and the way it works is a whole load of groups are all sharing one location, not an actual physical map, but they're all working in that map area. So the idea being that what they do is sort of interacting with everyone else that works in that, is working within that area. So you're getting your gold and silver rolling onto the survivor groups because they're all trying to do something in that location, whether it's based around that town or country area. It's quite artificial because obviously, like, there's no, it's not geographic as in a feature or a road. It is just the OS map. I've forgotten where I was wandering off to with that. I've bimbled off in some random direction about maps. But
No. The maps are important. It's just the overlap. So I think you've covered it there. But I suppose in those regions, I'm assuming that those different map regions could also interact with one another. But within the regions, at least, what's the gameplay loop, I suppose, for the two sides, the survivors and the government teams? What's the core focus of the gameplay?
So it's a very freeform roleplay end of mega games. All of the teams, and this is definitely something I learned from the first run to the later ones, every team has some actions which are written down. So each player gets an action per turn, and it can be whatever they absolutely want. It's completely free form, but they have to commit resources to it. So equipment, groups, their survivor group is cut down into these smaller units of sort of six or so people that work well together. They commit those to an action. They go off to one of our facilitators who scurries off to a hidden room to plot it all out on the map, come back with how it's resolved and tell a little bit of a story. So that's the main sort of action of how they can interact with the world in a sort of physical way. There's loads of sort of simpler tasks that they can assign their groups to, like popping out for local scavenging, fixing up their camp, resting their people and stuff like that. But the other bit of the overlaps and the area is politically driven. It is what these groups actually want to achieve within the long term. You know, society's just come out of this near extinction event. It's actually a chance to rebuild, to make a new kind of world. What do they want this world to look like? And they are quite radically different. The survivor groups are set up to either kind of almost oppose the government in terms of politically what it wants to do, or some of the more amusing ones want to do the government's job better than the government is doing it and advise them on it. So slightly annoying neighbours. And that's the two sort of main groups, which gives that sort of clash. In terms of, Chris said, the scale's different. The government groups probably could roll over with tanks over the survivors, but clearly they're not going to do a very good recovery if they just roll over all of the people that have survived. And then there is the fight for food, but the fight for food, I think, is a bit more personal rather than against each other.
Right, right. And so it sounds like it is a very sort of player brief-driven game, less crunchy mechanics and more relying on people to stick to their roles, play out their faction or their team's personality, and lean into the world building.
Yes. Rather than
lots of pieces on a map and that kind of thing.
Yeah, there's very few map moving pieces. I think in the sort of facilitator briefing, we talk about it being a fiction first type game. So I don't know how much role playing games you do, but sort of more fiction first genre, where actually what the players want to, being a fan of what the players are doing, being encouraging them, supporting them in trying to achieve their goals, and pushing that forward because that's fun. And that also generates more interactions. We want them talking to each other. The majority of the time is those teams speaking to each other, making their negotiations, stuff like that. The action part of it is sort of more to back up their words rather than, it's not driven by the actions and their negotiations secondary. It's their negotiations and their discussion first, hopefully backed up by these sort of more freeform actions.
Yep. And so you had this this game bouncing around your head in 2016. A couple of weeks later, you ran it. And then in the years to come, we saw the big Watch the Skies games that had hundreds and hundreds of people come along. And then we had a bit of a gap. And then very large, huge games came along, started running First Contact a couple of years, or last year, was it?
Yeah, last year.
So when did you decide, when and how did you decide that this would be the perfect game to upscale to that size? And I'm guessing it's about triple or maybe even quadruple the size of the original. How did you make that decision?
I think Chris went run aftermath.
Yeah, I think I nagged a lot. I nagged Zane incessantly, I think.
Should do Aftermath. I really like Aftermath.
Yeah, that one. It's really good. It's really good fun. Go on, do it. Come on, do it.
This is where I admit Aftermath nearly broke me and definitely broke one of my control, but it was quite a stressful run on that first one. But it was always designed to be scalable. Again, as part of the sort of emergency response stuff I was doing, it was all about scalable incidents and how you sort of build up and reduce a team around how much resource you need for a dealing with an incident. So the original Aftermath was built with scaling in mind, so actually the decision to scale it up was fairly easy because I knew what the scaling up would look like.
Okay.
There's a whole scaling plan somewhere, so it should, the same game should be able to run with the same rules from probably 22 people all the way up to 160, and probably could keep going if you could get enough facilitators to help run it. I think that's the limiting factor, is it's probably a bit facilitator heavy. But yeah, it's scalable and scalable. But yeah, the real reason we scaled it up is Chris wanting to play it again. Probably. Yeah. It's the real reason behind us doing everything, isn't it? So Chris can have a go.
Basically, yeah. I didn't get to go play though, but yeah. No, I played it in the first run in 2016, and I had such a blast. And I've always wanted Zane to run it again. And when we obviously started up very large, it was just, to me, it was an obvious thing to do because the game existed already, all the lore, everything. It was about scaling up the number of survivor teams, the number of gold and silver commands, giving them briefs. I mean, that almost broke us, I think, doing that. But it always made great sense that it was a relatively, in web game terms, relatively easy thing to do in order to scale up for us. So, yeah, and it was such fun. I found it great fun. I'm really sure, I mean, we didn't get a huge amount of feedback because we asked for it after the game runs, like a few days later. But everybody who did give feedback sort of loved it. And you can see in the day people running around. And like Zane says, it's primarily talking to each other. That's obviously where the game fun comes from. It's negotiating with others and, utilising your resources to perhaps backstab them, whatever else you're going to do. It was much fun. That's why I wanted to do it.
Yeah, and I think I'd regained confidence in it after it had run online a couple of times with, what's their acronym? The online mega game group, Omega. They ran it during lockdown. And then another friend of ours did a version of it at UK Expo, like our big game expo thing. And I think that gave me confidence that maybe it was okay, because I'd lost confidence in the game after my first run. And then we set a task to run it at sort of normal scale at UK Expo ourselves as well. So that sort of helped us drive it and get it into a good place, ready to scale it up, didn't it, Chris?
Yeah, exactly. It was like a normal, what's normal in mega game terms? It was about 40 players at Get Expo, so early this year in June. That was great fun as well. I think we had one of the Silver Command teams secede from the UK because they were so angry about what the Gold Command were demanding of them. But yeah, it was what I remember from 2016. The players had such fun interacting with each other and pulling off crazy schemes. Like Mad Max, like Zane says, Mad Max in the UK. It's very good.
Mad Max with tea and biscuits.
Exactly, yeah. Mad Max with tea and biscuits, that's it.
It sounds like it really was quite an easy task to scale up, but I can see why, imagining how this game runs, story first, like you said, and there's a lot of negotiation, the social side of it. What did you find that you needed to change anything major between, whether it was a matter of scaling or not, between the original and the one that you've run this year? Or was it just a matter of producing more content, like the briefings and the factions and that kind of thing?
So a couple of key things that definitely needed changing. One was amount of actions. So in the original run, they could actually write a list of actions, which almost killed the control team on that first run. So a group could write like five or so actions, and that and a control team's looking after two, I think possibly even three groups in that one. So they might be trying to resolve like 18 actions in like 20 minutes, which was just too much. So the first thing I did is limit that to one action per player, essentially. So each survivor group gets three actions, which is a bit more manageable. Any less than that, and I think the teams would feel like they weren't getting enough done. So that was the biggest change. And then I got to introduce some things I didn't quite get time to do on the first run, where I wanted pre-done event decks so the players could go off and do scavenging without help from control. So they could go off and do some sort of simple tasks sort of by themselves without any need to pull a facilitator in, so we could focus on the story elements. So we got those done. So they're the biggest sort of changes, was introducing that event deck and reducing the control. And then the biggest task was trying to write enough briefings for 160 odd people. Not that everyone gets an individual briefing, but a huge amount do get individual briefings, and the rest is focused on team ones.
Yep. And did most of those briefings come out of your brain, or was that a team effort? Because that's a lot of briefings.
We pulled a bit of a writer group together at the beginning, which really helped. So we got, I don't think I can remember everyone on the group, but there were about six people, weren't there, Chris, that we pulled together for that first sort of brainstorming. I mean, just even coming up with that amount of groups was quite hard. So we did a massive brainstorming, like what survivor groups will there be, and then sort of shortlisting those to the favoured 32, is it 32 survivor groups?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah,
there we are.
A lot.
30-something.
Yeah, 35, 32-something. A lot of survivor groups. So all of them needed to sort of feel individual, different, fun to play. And then they all needed briefings. Each one of those also needed individual and unique subgroups as well, little groups of six people with a little bit of background creating. So, yeah, it was a lot of work. Definitely not for me. I think I just vetted and made suggestions. Chris and others did the majority of that.
Certainly by the end, we did UKGE, which was June, and then the game ran in September, a few months ago. And certainly by the end of creating those ones after June, I think ChatGPT became very key, at least for sort of setting up something, and then we could riff off of it. But yeah, it became it was a lot to do, definitely.
Yes.
And that, and yeah. plus sort of reorganizing First Contact earlier in the year, it was a lot to do in this year.
Yeah. Well, that's where I was so surprised when we talked earlier in the year. I can't remember if it was on a podcast or prior, but and you were talking about bringing Aftermath to this scale. And I'm not sure what work had happened at that point, but it wasn't that long after that you actually ran the game. So it seemed like a lot of cramming happened this year. So huge, huge undertaking by you and the team. What was the, when you finally ran it last in September, how many facilitators did you end up needing per player? Because it sounds like that's been a huge factor since the first draft.
I think we had, was it sort of six people to one facilitator was the plan, Zane? It's around that sort of focus? Zane's gone on mute, but yes, it was around six people, six players, so two survivor groups of six players, or one gold command or a couple of silver commands, again, around six people per group. So yeah, it was very focused on making sure that players could write the couple of actions each. So I think the survivors got like two actions. So each survivor team, I think, got two actions, and then the gold commands got sort of three. So it was about limiting it, but also giving them enough to go and do what they want to do in the world, and obviously combine that with talking to other players. But yeah, with the actual day, we've in the run-up to it, we found we had a lot of facilitators drop out, and we had about, in total, I think 10 drop out, which and a few on the day as well. So it was quite difficult. I mean, we ran around in the morning trying to fix things, because we suddenly realised we didn't have enough people as the game started. Like, a couple of teams flagged to us. They didn't have anybody helping them or facilitating for them. So I think I took on another team, one of the couple of teams at the beginning, and then passed it off to somebody else as they went on. But we are very lucky. We put out a couple of calls via our website and our email list to sort of have folks help us. And the response has been amazing, honestly. I mean, for the first run of First Contact, we basically got our mega game friends to do it. Sort of coerced them into it, and they were amazing. Yeah. But obviously, we can't, you know, if we'd run a couple of games a year, we can't continue to rely on our mates to do that. So put out a call to the rest of the community and people who have sort of played our game, and we had a fantastic response. And again, because we're going to run First Contact again sort of March next year, March 2024, we've put out another call and a bunch more people have signed up. So yeah, I mean, Zane's very good, gives them training before the game runs, obviously. But yeah, this time around, I don't know if it was COVID. We did have a burst of COVID around the time of the game, so it could have been that sort of made people drop out, or just life in general, right, gets in the way. Things happen that you don't expect. But yeah, certainly with Aftermath being probably even more than First Contact, more of a facilitator-focused game, yeah, you need those folks, definitely, because otherwise, obviously, the more you get, more the drop out, the more it becomes pressure on the people who remain. So yeah,
especially it's an interesting one. With games at this scale, the logistics is so immense. You've got so many people to manage. That team needs to be pretty well oiled and pretty cool under pressure and know how to communicate with each other. So it's impressive that you've managed to get groups together for any of these events, I feel. It's great.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely, you're right. I mean, but we are very lucky with the people who help us. Like I say, we've got like a group of experienced mega gamers, I guess, that we absolutely do put into the very critical roles. We know that if there's a plot role that we need to make sure there's a very good person we know of that in there, but generally everybody helps us. They're, you know, they're really friendly, sort of focus on the players having a great day, and Zane runs excellent training sessions beforehand to explain the world, to explain mechanics, to explain, you know, the feel of what we want, and honestly, like the Discord book that we're recording on now and other free tools, it's just it makes it not easy, but it makes life better. Like you can organize things a lot easier with modern day tools.
Actually being able to talk to people and train people on the run-up, there's definitely some learning to do in training, but just having these online tools really, really helps with that, because it means you've connected with the majority of your your control team before the day, which used to be very difficult.
Yeah, and that's something we're looking at trying to master a bit more here on how we prepare our facilitation team. And I imagine it would only compound in complexity when you have so many people that you need to train and get on board with how things run, especially with a game like this where there isn't just a rule book of numbers that you can read through and digest and then know what to do, but there's quite a bit of sort of storytelling and social skills that you need to prime people for. So it's impressive that you can get a big team together for this. How did so other than the logistical side of things, having so many helping hands run the game, and having to sort of spread yourselves a little bit thin, other than that, on the day, how did everything run? How was the game at this size received? How did it compare to the original smaller versions, as far as player experience and the stories that came out of it, the kinds of, I suppose, in-game events that happened? Was it noticeably traceable, or was it a totally all-new beast?
Very similar from my perspective. I think there was sort of slightly less of that smaller community feel. I think in the smaller, normal-sized game, you build more interactions locally, like there's less people to talk with, but actually the similar type of themes came out across the game. It felt like it was the same game being run with the interactions. There were definite slight silos, I guess, of different bits of the game. Different areas of the game were developing their own narrative in their own ways, but there was cross-pollination from those narratives to each other. It was really, really interesting. I think it ran quite well at that scale. If we'd have definitely had five more facilitators, it would have been probably 10 times as good, just because the added pressure. There were some great stories came out of it, very similar stories to the smaller runs. There are probably too many to bring up. But as I said, the circus that were getting rid of people. They were inviting people to come along to their shows, and then people were disappearing in their shows, and then they were selling hot dogs. Lots of
the young farmers also. They were canned goods, weren't they?
Yes. There were just so many funny little bits coming out afterwards.
One for me was we had a group called the Cult of the Dying Sun, which essentially they predicted the end of the world, as they always do, and it actually came to pass. And they obviously now trying to decide what to do next, because they lost their leader and stuff. But those for players kind of dressed up. I mean, they were amazing. They dressed up these full-on red robes and what have you. But you'd imagine, like most people would imagine, that the Cult of the Dying Sun are, you know, the evil team basically, but they managed to charm everybody, and by the end they were forming a government with Gold Command. Quite incredible to watch, just watching them negotiate like what the new rules are going to be. They wanted theocracy, obviously. The government would just, in the end, I think they gave in and gave them what they wanted. It was just quite incredible to watch from a distance. But yeah, I think Zane's right. I think it just sort of, the stories, and that they scale up as well. Obviously, I mean, they do, don't they? Right, they just scale up as well. It's just a bigger run of a previous game, really, I suppose.
Having so many, I mean, there's so many sort of, negative themes in this setting. It's obviously a bit post-apocalyptic. It's a bit end of the world, but it's literally about rebuilding. So there is a bit of hope sewn into the setting, I suppose. How do you find Games of Aftermath end up ending? Because narratively, a lot of mega games have the last turn madness, and they have pretty doom and gloom endings and lots of betrayals and last minute plot twists and that kind of thing. Was this any exception?
It's definitely an element of sort of last turn madness, but the sort of narrative arc tends to be, we're coming to another sort of winter. And you've got sort of three turns to start making sure you're ready to hunker back down. So it's a sort of, you've sort of blossomed out. You're doing all your big plans, but actually you need to sort of consolidate a little bit, make sure you're in a good position. So it's that sort of trying to push the narrative to say you need to think about the future. If you do short-term crazy objectives now, your group's not actually going to survive. Think about how you're going to set up, get self-sufficient, and survive through another intense, crazy weather event where you're not going to be able to go out. So, I mean, it's not... I mean, I think we struggle, don't we, on all mega games to get a good narrative end. So it is always a sort of a push towards, oh, it's all going to get bad again, a little bit. I don't know, Chris, have you got any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, last term madness is definitely a thing, and obviously we try to mitigate that by not saying exactly when the game will end, but people know that it's going to be like 5 p.m.-ish. So I think just generally things are building throughout the day as well. People got more resources, more ability. The more radical teams are going to want to fight against the government structures and probably do some bombings and things by the end of it. So, I guess it ends with crescendo. We I know, Zane, you've talked about wanting to sort of do foreshadowing things, and maybe we'll do that with the next first contact and bring bigger sort of set pieces into the game as it runs on to sort of change things or let the players focus on something new. I think it's all part of the experience, right? Like, as long as it doesn't ruin anybody's day, it's all part of the fun, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that last turn was either the government trying to crush some crazy survivors or crazy survivors trying to crush the government. Yes. for a lot of teams.
Rolling out the British Army all over the place.
Yeah, or quite a lot of unification between survivor groups, like you say, Cult of the Dying Sun becoming the new state religion or whatever.
Something not necessarily to avoid last turn madness per se, but something that we have been experimenting with here is trying to steer the game at the end so that people don't fall into that trap, or they have something to work towards, or they don't feel that investing in that thing that won't be completed at the end of the last turn is a wasted action. It sounds like you kind of tried to do something similar here, with giving a bit of a narrative sort of explanation about what the epilogue would look like. Do you feel like that worked? Were player actions in the second half or the last quarter of the game starting to wind down and consolidating, or did they just go normal mega game style?
I think they went the normal mega game, sort of pushing for bigger and bigger last turn. I think in a larger game, we probably get it slightly worse, where there's a little bit of everyone wants to be remembered for their actions, don't they? You want to be the one that we mention on a chat like this. So there's a lot of people, but I think they always push their actions because, they want to be the team that people mention. So there's always that drive. Because of that scale, we can't do debriefs. And I think me and Chris push a little bit away from debriefs because they take a long time, and I don't think you always get the most out of it. But in this one, what we did, and I was quite pleased because it wasn't an original idea at the start, it was something sort of dawned on me, I think, towards the end of the game, was because a facilitator was looking after generally two teams. What we did is for the last turn, if they just sat down with their teams, on a sort of not one-to-one but sat with them as a group and did a sort of final session as a bit of just free-form chat through of sort of this is what you're trying to achieve, this is the sort of arc of where you're going, you know, what are you trying to do, and sort of talk through and sort of gave them a bit of an ending doing that, which I think worked quite well with a lot of the teams. I don't know if you got any feedback on that, Chris, or how you found it, because unlike you, Chris, I just walk around on the day not really doing anything, but I forced you to actually control some teams.
And that's my plan, is to have a cup of tea and wander around enjoying the experience. But no, this time around I had to do some work. I think so. I facilitated a couple of Silver Commands. It was about, they didn't. One of them actually did go to war with some teams in the end. It was about sort of how they would rebuild and what they were planning to do after that. And then the other team were much more sort of. I think they were part of the Call of the Dying Sun group. They were sort of how they were going to move forward with this new theocracy that they were going to be managing. I think it was a good way of ending the game and gave players some sort of closure as well. Like, obviously, everybody thinks, you know, this is what I would have done in the future. But it was nice to sort of have that sort of co-creation experience. Definitely.
And so I believe with very large, huge games, you have something coming up early next year.
That's right. So we're going to run First Contact, but with a bit of a twist. It's called First Contact Reign of Terror this time. And so it's going to run on the 9th of March in 2024 in the same location in central London. As we've done before, and because we've run the game twice now, we kind of thought it's very important to switch the aliens up, so that's what we're doing. We're kind of foreshadowing some stuff that's going to happen with our artwork, but it's basically new aliens completely, and we're going to look at the objectives of the rest of the team, so the corporations, the scientists, the countries, and the UN, and probably just we're very proud of them, I think, what we've done with them. But obviously, it's just about changing some bits and pieces and with what's happening in the world right now, and change them up a little, only a tiny bit, but enough to change them slightly. And then, that will run next year. So again, an all-day, full-day game. This time, it's going to be for 175 players rather than 200. We're very much looking forward to it. It should, and because Becky Ladley did the, very luckily, we had a TikTok she created for us from the last First Contact earlier this year, which I think had about 1.5 million viewers, something like that. And people watch it, so we'll be training that as well. But I think that's got a few people who are interested who've never seen a mega game before, and so we thought that obviously you don't necessarily know what First Contact is, but if you've seen a video of it, it looks fun, then we thought that'd be good to bring back, but with different aliens this time around. So very much looking forward to running it.
Very exciting. So that'll be number 3 for First Contact. Is that a subtle sign that we will see 2 more aftermaths as well?
No, we're gonna do. We talked a lot about this actually in the last few weeks and a month or so. But we're gonna do First Contact definitely on the 9th of March, and we've got another game next October, which we're not gonna announce yet. But it's gonna be something completely different. That the team are very excited about. We'll bring out more information about that probably once First Contact runs. It should be pretty completely different and pretty exciting.
And what aftermath do you think? Zane, it's still available as a smaller format mega game, is that correct?
Yeah, so currently just repackaging it with all the sort of new artwork we've done for these runs, and create it so that you can scale it for whatever size fits you. So I want to put that in a place where it's easy to sort of pick up, print and play kind of for it, so that more people can enjoy it. Because I think our objective, very large, huge games, is trying to get more people into mega gaming. So anything we can do that makes it more accessible to actually get people, hence the sort of 200 player ones, we get a huge amount of new players. I think 75% generally new players. All runs, which is, I think, amazing. And the same with getting Aftermath into a place where I can get it played in other places. It played in Canada in 2017 or something like that, but that's outside of the UK the only time it's been run. So it'd be nice to see other games out there that people can pick up, set up and run fairly easily. I mean, we'd like to do the same with First Contact, but that beast is a bit more complex.
Well, I will definitely be on your mailing list for when Aftermath is packaged up. I'm keen to get my hands on it. I'm pretty sure I did read the original, but it sounds like a revised version. It sounds pretty good to me. So keep us informed.
Without giving too much away, Zane is working on it at the moment to package it up. So hopefully, relatively soon, we'll have it on our website to sell. We definitely, as a group, want to do that for sure.
And so there's no more Aftermath on the horizon, per se, but Zane, if someone comes to you tomorrow and says, please come and run this game again for us next year, we've got 170 people ready to come along. Do you think you could do it again?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if we've got the facilitator team, that's probably my biggest thing, is sort of say, can we train and get the facilitator team into a good place? Then absolutely. Run it every month if we had a good enough people to and enough people to run it. It's very fun to run. I think fun to actually facilitate as well. That's another key bit that I'm trying to get into the stuff that we're designing, is this fun also for the control team? I know I flip between the word control and facilitator, because in my world, I want facilitator used, because we don't control anything. We only facilitate what the players are doing. So,
I've been having the exact same sort of, I want to say argument, but really it's just me rambling about it. But the same rhetoric about that down here as well. I feel like the control just doesn't really satisfy what the reality of the situation.
Exactly. No, and as new players coming in as well, like, I think the word of facilitator makes more sense to someone who's not part of the Megatame community. Control has that nice history to it, but makes very little sense if you're outside of the Mega Game community. So I push for facilitator as wherever I possibly can. I'll try to make all of our guns fun to facilitate. I mean, it's not always possible for every facilitator role to be fun, but I think they should be. We should be having fun running it.
No, I definitely agree with that. So I won't pry much more on whatever is coming next year in October, but looking forward to hearing about it. Obviously, very very large, huge games. We will have links to your stuff in the show notes, and also I will throw a link to that article you mentioned earlier, Zane, about the original Aftermath run. Is there anything else either of you would like to plug before we wrap up here?
No, I don't think so. Just to say that, like we said, First Contact's going to be Brand New Aliens on the 9th of March. So if you're in London and you fancy a chance to play as a corporation or a country or the UN, then yeah, join up to our main list or buy a ticket when they come out on the 25th of November.
I hope that's your tagline. Brand New Aliens, 9th of March.
It will be now.
That's all you need to know.
And, you know, some people have come over from Australia, so, you know, it's not too far to go. We had one of our facilitators was from Australia for Aftermath, so.
Well,
you're welcome anytime.
Maybe one day.
Not a problem.
I'm sure we can do you some sort of ticket.
That's very, very generous. It's not the ticket. That's not the ticket I'm worried about. No. Thank you both. Really appreciate chatting. Hopefully we'll get to chat to you again in the new year, because it sounds like there's lots happening in the space, and keen to hear about what you have planned after First Contact. But thank you both, and good luck with the rest of your days.
Very much. Same to you.
Thank you.